It's meant simply to give you some clue about the way I will be structuring this process. And that sentence is as follows. Sexuality is a function of politics, comma, of economic conditions, of environmental degradation and well-being, semicolon. This is a long sentence. Sexuality is a function of visions of justice and of obedience and trust. And sexuality is a function of physical, spiritual health. I believe that some of the time, and disbelieve it at other times, and hope to encourage us in this weekend to move into discombobulation, to off-center ourselves, to know less when we end than we think we do now, but to honor what we do know about sexual ethics and sexuality at every stage. And part of what I'm hoping to do by this sentence is to encourage us to make many, many, many connections in the course of the weekend. Connecting things we didn't think had a thing to do with each other. Like, how does sexuality change when the unemployment rate is higher than 8%? Do you find lust rising or falling with the inflation rate? And such questions. Now, you will find that at my best, I adhere to strict feminist pedagogical criteria, among which are, there ain't no front of this room. And this structure is very, very, very important, so that we are egalitarian and, if we are really hardworking, equal in what we're doing here. And I am simply a provocateur at best. So, if you have paper and pencil, this is not an exam, but I'm serious. How many need a pen or a pencil? If you don't have it, we have to share, because this is going to be some writing. If it's not a long trip, Margaret, that would it looks like that would be. I wish I'd remember the flashlight too.
Oh yeah.
He told me.
Very important.
Yes, we were going to have to pray a lot on electricity.
Anybody have an extra pen or pencil?
Well, I think I have a ton of them, but
they're fetching some equipment. So
thank you.
1 second. What I'm going to ask you to do is not any kind of test of your value as a species or as a person on the planet, anything like that. So this, you cannot fail what you're now going to do. While we're waiting for some additional writing tools, you might think about how your body is feeling at the moment. Great, wonderful. Thank you, Margaret, very much. Okay, anybody need equipment? Just
I would like the pins back.
Dream on, Margaret. says redistribution of wealth.
FDR era?
Yes.
This is extra. Put that in box. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to do some sentence completion, fill in the blank, and other activities. And if at any point you don't want to, don't. This is, you don't lose your agency by virtue of showing up at Old Billy, so. If at any point you are significantly uncomfortable, pay attention to that, but remember that in discomfort, a lot of interesting things can sometimes happen. So, if you are a ready, easy draw, a person who draws readily, you can move into this first step quite quickly. If you aren't, you might want to switch to your so-called non-dominant hand, which is interesting language in itself. We already know a lot about sexuality in this culture by our language about left and right-handedness and dominance. But I would like you, if you would be willing, to draw a shape, and if draw is too heavy a word, sketch or whatever, a shape without any words, which shows you, because you aren't going to show this to anybody unless you want to. A shape which shows you how you feel, and I'm going to ask you to start putting that pen or paper, that pen to paper as soon as I stop talking, so you don't think. Do not think about what you're going to do. Just start doing it as soon as I say what it is. You're going to draw a shape about how you feel about being sexual. Just sketch it right now. Don't think. Okay? Everybody ready? Number two, sentence completion. And this is for everybody in the room. To be female is powerful in that, complete the sentence. To be female is powerful in that, number three, you might want to leave yourself space in the course of the evening. You can fill in additional things if you think of it. Number three, sentence completion. My deepest fear about sexuality is, my deepest fear about sexuality is, four, sentence completion again. Sexual joy That's it, just make a sentence that ends that. Sexual joy There are 10 of these just for the break purposes. 5. If I could make one rule about sex that would apply to everyone, it would be, if I could make one rule about sex that would apply to everyone, it would be, get paper?
No, but that's all right.
Okay.
I need to settle down.
Okay. This next one asks you to draw on your sense of color. If you have, if you think in terms of grays and blacks and whites primarily, go with that. So if you don't have color sensitivity other than that, that's fine. Number six, when I think of sensuality, the color that is like this is, when I think of sensuality, the color that is like this is now, I don't know you people by and large, so I don't know if you want to do this next one, but you can do it or not. I'd like you, if you would like to do it, and I don't know why not, to stand first. And what I'd like you to do is put your body then in a stance or a shape or a position or a posture, which is what your body would look like if it looks like what you understand God is. Now, I know that many of you are Lutherans and you've never, ever, ever used your body to express what you think. But we won't get very far this weekend unless we're all willing to be a little different from who we usually are.
She wants to stand up and do this.
So stand. You can then sit again. You can lie again. I don't care, but no.
Just move your body.
Static deity.
You wanted some dancing.
By and large, yes. Greek philosophy is very much with us.
There wasn't room to do too much.
We might try that again later. How many of you, just out of curiosity, found it necessary to touch someone else in order to do that? Anybody? Two out of the group so far. Think about that. We've learned a lot in this, if we start thinking about that a bit. Okay, we have three more before the next stage of this. So this is a sentence completion. Sexual morality these days. Sexual morality these days. Number nine. I feel most alive when I feel most alive when and number 10 and finally in this segment, if I were another sex, my life would change most in that If I were another sex, my life would change most in that or if that's too convoluted, if you were another sex, your life would be different. In what way? Now, I propose, and remember, friends, there is much to be said for rebellion, but I'm proposing, if you are amenable to it, to taking about 15 minutes, just shifting in whichever way you want to, that is far or just right where you are, meeting with two other or maybe three other people, and introduce yourselves to each other by talking about any element of this that you want to, and if you don't, talk about something else then. I think it's very important to start to find out who we are rather than just do this sort of universally. You willing to do that? Just take some time to share what you already bring to this conversation? Good. So no more than four, because the groups then get too big, but three or four people together, and just converse about elements of what you've just written or done. About 15 minutes on this section. I'd like to just check. How many of you actually told each other your names in this process?
We knew each other's names.
One of the places I'm currently working is called Women's Theological Center in Boston. And in the program I'm now working, half of the women studying there are from Korea. And I've been intrigued to learn that in Korea, when you introduce yourself to each other, you do not use names. That's not the most important thing by a long shot. You name each other according to your age. So everybody knows within short order where you stand in the sequence of age, because it's very important who is older than whom. Think of why we think in the United States that a name is so important as that device. Because we could use all sorts of things. So we could say, well, hello, I'm Elizabeth, and I think orgasm is the greatest thing on toast. And what do you think about orgasm? And then we would really know something useful. Part of what we're going to be doing this weekend is asking questions that unsettle what we take as self-evident. I want to say three quick things about that and then do an agenda check, then turn to this video. The three things I want to say about the shape of the weekend are, first, that we will be looking at restructuring and reshaping power. Power as a focal analytical category. And I'm assuming that most of you know by now that in feminist and other work, the interpretation of power has been shifted from the model of dominance to the model of cooperation. But what that means, we are in the process of working out. And we're working it out in every institution in which we participate, whether that's a local congregation or as a CEO of an international corporation, or here at Holden. Wherever it is, we are structuring power and trying to see if we can't move out of the notion that power is zero-sum domination. What would cooperative power look like in sexual intercourse? Many of us think we know, which is hilarious in itself. The second aspect of this is reclaiming agency. agency is a sort of an N word these days, but I mean by that, especially for women, but not only for women, but especially for women, to reclaim that way of being on planet Earth, which says that we have something to say about what it means to be on planet Earth. That is, women belong here and are creating what it means to be here. For some men, it's also important to say that they are reclaiming that knowing because they've also been in social situations which have taught it out of them or forced it out of them, pressed it out of them, like certain coffee makers press the ground coffee through the water. And some of us have been treated like that in institutions and have had all the vitality of us pressed out. So how can we say to hell with that model? Literally, that's a theological claim. And God, you're a strange group of people. This is going to be harder work than I had thought. The third aspect is to re-ask the most basic questions, everything that we think we know for sure. Should be re-asked at least weekly. Why? Because we are constantly in processes of change, and every old answer, unless it's re-asked, will become an answer to a question that doesn't exist anymore. So we might come up with basically the same reconfiguration, but the re-asking is crucial. And in the area of sexual ethics, the most basic of those most basic questions is, who decides what's going on? Who decides what's going on? And that takes me to a quick agenda check. I want to let you know how I'm envisioning these six sessions in the agenda that you've got. And then I will propose that we look at this video, which is a very interesting video. My proposal for our retreat topically is as follows. Tomorrow we have three sessions, two in the morning and one in the evening, and the afternoon is for checking out how slushy is that stuff. The session in the morning, the topic is generally religion and sexuality. I would like to speak for about 20 to 25 minutes myself in that session to talk about some historical origins of Christianity in particular and how that shapes certain ways that we interpret, have interpreted sexuality. And we will be doing some small group conversation again in that session. After the coffee break, we will look at another video, Electrons Willing, and that is Elizabeth's latest collection of MTV, which is, I don't know, the deity somehow provides. Every time I have to do a weekend retreat on sexuality, MTV gets really juicy. And I love this collection of MTV. For tomorrow, there are about 10 videos, so it's about 40 minutes of looking at this. And in the evening, then, the topic is guilt and redemption. Just to have a quick conversation about that. But so that you're aware, one of the themes that I'd like us to address is the question of salvific pain, how that's been theologically and otherwise, and I'll be drawing on the Janus Report on Sexuality for some really sobering information on people in the United States on that question. And Sunday morning, then, we have the fifth session on visions of justice. And while we will be addressing questions of labeling ourselves as sexual beings all along, I want to argue in that Sunday morning session that lesbians and gay men and maybe bisexuals, although I'm a little less clear about that myself at the moment, function theologically as subversive prophets. And I hope we can elaborate that among ourselves. And then I'm suggesting also that on Monday morning, I have not specified a topic there because I think that that's important for us as a group to do. So I would invite you to think between now and tomorrow morning session about these topics. And this is all up for group negotiation. I can go home and we can discuss the Celtics from now until Monday and I'll be happy. So it makes no difference really to me in that sense, but I care passionately about my topics, but if you have others, that's terrific too. I just give you those topics now, but we'll take this up at the beginning of tomorrow morning session to see how you adjust and feel about that. The video that I would like us to use this evening is, the word boring would not spring to mind about this video. It is a video that is produced on an exhibit at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, an exhibit that just opened, called Dress Codes. And it is an exhibit which asks the question, whatever led us to think that gender is a box? So that if you're in one gender box, you aren't in another gender box. If I were to ask you now to say, how do you know that you are male or female? You might well be able to come up with some physiological response that would lead you to think that you'd answered the question. If I ask you, what does it mean to be feminine or masculine? That might get a little more interesting. But you will notice in one of my questions, I avoided using the common phrase, if you were the opposite sex, what would be different? I said another sex. I suspect many of you assumed that there were two. Which is interesting in itself. I mean, who decided that there were two sexes? Who decided they were opposite? Are they opposite? How many sexes do you really think there are? That's something of what this video is about. This video is not about lesbians and gay men, although there are lesbians and gay men in the video, but do not make the mistake of thinking that if you are self-defined heterosexual that you aren't in this video. So watch it really carefully because it's a marvelous mess of interesting questions, namely it's like life. So you might want to shift your chairs, and it takes 35 minutes, and 35 minutes is what it takes. And we will have some time for some conversation at the end of it. So unlock any locks on your mind and heart and body. Yep, we're ready for it. Yeah, there are two screens here for the VCR. If the lights go out, we'll just wait until the electricity comes back on.
Back through history in every culture, everybody is in drag. Because every day we get up and we construct ourselves. There's academic drag, there's military drag, there's high culture drag.
Being a drag queen is a state of mind, not about clothes.
Being a leather dyke was always pushing one's boundary of identity.
Race and gender and sexuality are the informed bedrock of this society.
Mm-hmm.
can often occur at moments of violent social upheaval or in certain social change, when the society is reorganizing how it thinks about things like genders and class and the political hierarchies of gender. Very often, and also happens when there's political anxiety, when they're at the edge of a war, for example, there's a great outbreak of cross-dressing in the 20s in Europe, in England, all the same in the United States. Anxiety around the end of the war, flapper haircuts, women in tuxedos, women in towns, Marlene Dietrich setting the style for a whole block of generation.
Cross-dressing was so pervasive during and after World War I that Charlie Chaplin cross-dressed in an entire film called A Woman of 1915, but the U.S. Army funded extensively massive shows throughout Europe during 1918 and 1919 after the war had ended of soldiers cross-dressing and putting on theatrical productions for their fellow soldiers. I think that cross-dressing is acceptable, not in the streets, but in the theaters. Not in your home, but on the movie screen. And these kind of sanctioned sites of cross-dressing allow straight culture to get the benefit of the joys of being able to laugh at the other.
He is not defending. He
And if you're able to laugh, you're able to reassure yourself that nothing's wrong, okay? But when you see the drag queen in the street, then a lot of people see something as perversely wrong, which needs to be rectified in some way.
When I was about 8 years old, I was fascinated with my mother's, you know, watching my mother get dressed and putting makeup on. And I did a little drag show for my friends, which was great. And my friends loved it, and I loved it, and we had a great time. And they went home and told their parents, and Hunter is, like, dressing in his mother's clothes and dancing around the room for us. And their parents called my parents, and I was actually banned from playing with my friends for some time. So I sort of kind of self-imposed homophobia, which I think exists a lot among gay men, especially surrounding drag. Drag exists as a kind of underclass within the gay community, and I wanted to address this issue for myself. I worked with a friend of mine, a photographer, and we set up a situation where I just shaved my beard, and each step was photographed along the way. I was supposed to go to the kitchen to see Christian Marclay perform, and my roommate came to pick me up, and I said, I can't go, I don't have time to get out of drag. He said, no, no, you have to go. You have to go like this. So I went to the kitchen, full drag. We were introducing myself as a performance artist from Los Angeles named Tina. And I was being introduced to, like, my best friends. And what I saw was this instant register in their faces and in their eyes of embarrassment, intimidation, humiliation, hostility, and I was shocked. She's a media hog, and she loves her photograph taken, and she, you know, loves the center of attention. And, you know, I was a little pissed off at her this summer because she stole my boyfriend last year, and, you know, what can you do?
Fascinating phenomenon, because it is both visible and invisible. People pass for a day as well as for a lifetime. They pass as a way of doing a personal dare or
testing the boundaries of their cultural audience, the people they see on the street. Passing it can be deadly serious or it can be a game.
So, how are the cops treating you here in jail?
Well, jail is not all it's cracked up to be in the photo flick. The decor is horrid. The cops themselves, idiots. They might be that comment or anything.
You know, when you come and see my performances, it's clear that I'm not trying to pass as a woman. Some people do that kind of thing. That's not my work. It's more about questioning the representation of gender. And the only time I've played any drag other than a drag queen was when I was a eunuch in the show Pure Polyester. But I was a eunuch, and this was the top of my costume as a eunuch. And he had his balls, which are kind of tiny around his neck, but they're kind of tiny because, you know, he was still a kid when he became a eunuch. They're not that small either, I don't know. What I find fascinating is the relationship between what is going on for a person inside and the way they choose to represent it to people.
Provincetown is one of those Halloween spaces in which gay people have for generations gone and expressed themselves. Artists have gone and expressed themselves. It's a place in which the unpredictable is the predictable. I first met Marriott Pappy Allen when we were both attending a conference for crossdressers.
Up to now, most of the members in this community have been completely hidden from society. They've been mostly closeted. The average person in the community is a straight married man whose wife may or may not know, and is not what we think of more commonly as the crossdresser that you see in performances. I think it is because of the gradual change in the political climate that I was able to find enough people who were willing to say, yes, this is me, this is who I am, I care about it, and I'm not ashamed, I'm not embarrassed, and I want people to know that I'm out there. What I've done also that is probably new is to try to include family members, wives and siblings and parents and children, because I realized again fairly early on that this was what I wanted to do was to show these people in relationships and it's sort of in the daylight of everyday life rather than hiding in the back rooms of bars or in motel rooms. Renee and Kevin were married originally as Rich and Karen about 7 months earlier. And Renee's wife, wanting to really show how much she loved and supported her husband, was willing to get remarried again and have the whole wedding be cross-dressed.
Paquet is a Belgian artist who uses gender crossing and crossing within gender as aesthetic strategies. Paquet occupies positions of ambiguous sexuality and unclear gender. Madame as older woman, or it, as an almost male androgyne, to show us how the world responds to those persons whose social position is indeterminate. Like a singular or particular version of the masses, her presence on the streets is a performance of the ordinary, or the normal, to show clearly how these terms are constructed. For of course, if we believe in democracy and individuality, it is precisely such people who need to be made visible, or who need to be brought to speech within the social sphere. It is the presence of such anonymous figures who remind us how we are all seen and constructed.
I think that we are at a cultural moment when the political roles and the sexual roles of men and women are very much in flux, up for grabs, that we're seeing a continuum of sexualities and a continuum of gender roles, and that that is both exciting to people and also terrifying to people. A particularly interesting example of the way that cross-dressing is more about the physical body than about the actual, you know, adoption of clothing is the work of, you know, Yasu Matsumori Mura. And he is able to kind of tap into the stereotypes of the Asian male body, specifically that the Asian male body, because it is, quote unquote, too small, too hairless, and purportedly has a penis which is so small that it's not worth looking at anyway, is always going to be considered effeminate, effeminized, unsexy, and desexualized. His work, Big Sister, where he is not simply dressed as a white model, presumably from the pages of Vogue, but he's in fact dressed as Coco Chanel herself. In the 20s, her fashion was completely radical because it allowed women to start wearing pants, and women started wearing sporting clothes, and Coco Chanel herself, in some ways, was seen as an instigator of female cross-dressing. Duchamp's work is very, very important to Mori Mura, and Duchamp's image of himself cross-dressed as Rosé LaVie is perhaps the most famous image within art history of male cross-dressing. In Mori Mura's, you have Mori Mura as Duchamp, as Rosé LaVie, both a displacement of gender and a displacement of race again, so that he's wearing two hats and has two sets of arms, one yellow, Asian, and one white. So Mori Mura, in his work, consistently is able to interrogate the concept of race through interrogating the concept of gender.
As a man, a woman's a woman.
Well, why can't I dress in women's clothes? That's weird. I'm a cross-dresser. I've been dressing in men's clothes, performing in men's clothes, going out in men's clothes for about 11 years.
And this is what I use for penis. It's basically a bandage that's sewn either end, and it's stuffed with cotton wool wadding.
It's taken me 10 years to get to a place where I can actually pass as a man.
You know, it's quite small. You don't want it to be too big.
I teach these drag king workshops where women become men.
These are the bandages to bind your breasts, to flatten them.
I've tried to do Diane's workshop twice since, and I always find some excuse not to. And I think that it did something for me, that it made me braver in some very peculiar way. Like, immediately after, I had some benefit of being able to speak my mind in ways I hadn't.
It takes a lot of courage for women to make that step. It's not easy, but I think when they do become men, they learn a lot about themselves as women, and the things that they do automatically, like smiling all the time to make people feel good, you know, it's not necessary. It's not necessary to be constantly making concessions and accommodating the world. Let the world come to you.
Canadian artist Colin Campbell has been making videotapes and films for more than 20 years. In Hollywood and Vine, Campbell features the cross-dressed woman from Malibu who was assembled in all her glory before us.
Sometimes I cannot hear.
Campbell's character recalls her husband's hobby of assembling skeletons of dead animals, and then, in search for skeletons, or perhaps to reinvent memories of her husband, she wanders off into the desert, never to return.
House Portland. Cabbage Jacks.
In his Dangling by Their Mouth, Campbell creates the story of the relationship between an art critic and three people, her lesbian lover, a Canadian theater actor-director, and a young gay theater performance artist who adopts her persona in performance. In the end, like modern-day soap operas, his images and stories of everyday world with humor and irreverence.
Are there any questions?
And I buy you a drink.
The resurgence of drag in a mainstream arena really signals the return to beauty and what's special about life. Of course, we all know that drag queens are the shaman of our time, and they always have been shaman, you know. People who remember the myths and remember what's beautiful and what's powerful and what's important about life. Drag is a celebration of life. It's like celebrating my body and decorating it and decking it out. If you go down to Wall Street, you're gonna wear a three-piece suit, and I ain't sure. Or if you go cooking in the kitchen, in the country kitchen, cook crack. You'll probably wear an apron, right? And it's all drag.
A transvestite does not have a self that can call it his own or her own, because he impersonates both a man and a woman. I have often used my own history, that is in Latin America and in Australia, in opposition to the mainstream Western history of Europe and America. What interests me the most, a transvestism of forms of the Baroque into the Indian culture. Nothing if not abnormal reflects the image of the Prime Minister of Australia, Mr. Bob Hawke, back then, and his treasurer, Mr. Paul Keating. It's a political satire. I've often referred to sexuality and religion in my work through the procedure of allegory. The word condom cannot be mentioned in Chile. So we Chileans resort to allegory to deal with this situation. And we do carry condoms.
I'm really interested in terms of, like, you know, impossible, unnaming, you know, how do we specifically talk about somehow in the context of dress code, to talk about, you know, drag, but in relationship to somehow race. You know.
Show, I know I've got a whole gang of people, about three or four carloads of people. I didn't really have any idea what this work was like. I had my fingers crossed, you know, and it wouldn't be too shocking. Everybody was very polite. They looked at the work, and, you know, I sort of held my breath and looked at the work. What I see there was tame compared to what I see now.
As a black gay male,
he is carving out an area that is really not that tapped into, and there's sort of a directness towards direct male sexuality, black male sexuality specifically.
When we were growing up, we had these games in which we became, you know, women and girls, and we dressed up in our mother's clothes, especially after our father left. And gay blonde was the first wig, you know, the blonde wig and the white makeup. I loaned to him.
So queen, or excuse me, this girl is both blackness, whiteness, femininity, masculinity. So to incorporate it all.
Insight into him and what his life is like and what his life has been other than being my little boy. I mean, what is it as he's outside in the world and he has to face all of these things being a gay black young man?
His constant fight with, or his constant pushing of boundaries, of examining masculinity, of examining femininity, examining what those things mean, I guess has expanded my sense of who I am as a man, what maleness and masculinity is.
When I was in kindergarten, I had a teacher who was not very fond of black students. There were very few.
Howardina Pindell is an African-American artist intensely committed to addressing contemporary social issues such as racism, sexism, politics, war, and international human rights.
You really must be paranoid. Your art really isn't political either.
Free, white, and 21 deploys cross-dressing to talk about race. Howardina Pindell's personal narrative about experiences of racism is marked by the responses of her white counterpart. She uses this character to speak about the unquestioned privilege of being white and the mandatory sanction that must be granted for her personal and artistic validation.
Therefore, she would not put me in the accelerated course. You know, you really must be paranoid. Those things never happened to me. I don't know anyone who's had those things happen to them. But then, of course, they're free, white, and 21, so they wouldn't have that kind of experience.
Passing is a word that is applied both to gender and to race, and that's very interesting. That people have passed racially and they have passed gender to enable them to enter a world otherwise apparently closed or barred to them.
Of women consists of looking for signs of lesbian existence in history. When I first found that image of Calamity Jane, I was struck by how her femininity really came out and spoke to me. For instance, the hand on the barrel of the rifle, I thought was quite a beautiful hand, and the gesture of her hand on her lap still spoke to me as something quite feminine, even though she's wearing what is typically masculine clothing. On the one hand, I hide those aspects, and in the second panel of the work, I then reveal those so that we can look at them closer. I go to archives and ask to see images of transgressive women. And I feel like I'm looking for buried treasures.
women in non-traditional roles, military women, women working in areas that aren't normally considered women's work. A lot of people say, well, was that woman a lesbian? And for me, that's not my major concern. It's how women relate to each other, how they present themselves, how perhaps they might transgress certain gender codes. I realized that I had a range of photographs of women from very different backgrounds. And instead of having a comparative relationship, I turned the grid on its side to make this diamond shape in an attempt to make connections among these very different women. My work really reflects my lived experience as a woman, as a feminist, and as a lesbian.
I came out in San Francisco, and I came out in a leather dyke community in the early 80s. And being a leather dyke was always pushing one's boundary of identity. So I left San Francisco to pursue my photography in a more serious way. And I finally found a group of dykes who I thought were really playing around with stuff. And that was the friends who I photographed, Pigpen and Chicken. The photographs are meant to be in your face, and they're also meant to make you really think about whether or not that they were male or female. But a lot of people approach me and say, no, you're tricking me, Kathy. You have some guys in here. You really have some guys in here. And it's like, no, it's all lesbians. That cholo look and the mustaches and stuff that represent that comes from living in Los Angeles, all of us living in very poor neighborhoods that are predominantly run by gangs. My friends are not academics. My friends are community-based people. They do massage work, they do paint, they paint houses, they hang out together. And they're not really so much concerned with the theoretical construction around what queer is right now. They're more interested in doing it than thinking about it. On Halloween about 5 years ago, a gay friend of mine said, why don't we dress up and go over to Santa Monica Boulevard and do some bar hopping? And I said, okay, I'll do James Joyce. I'll be the greatest modernist writer in history. I devised a retrospective exhibition for a fictitious lesbian artist and called it Peter, a Young English Girl. The reference is to the portrait of the painter Gluck by Romaine Brooks. The show deliberately included an aggrandizing photo blow-up of me, cross-dressed as a turn-of-the-century artist dandy. The following were comments in response to that work. Lesbian feminist stranger. I was totally insulted and outraged by the title of Young English Girl. She was clearly an adult woman. Closeted lesbian dealer. No one is as interested in this as you are. There are no collectors for this work. Isn't there something else in your life to make art about? A merkin actually is a term for a pubic wig, which also happened in the 18th century when people were much more into full-blown drag of various sorts. They're modeled on a drawing, which I found in the back of a study of homosexuality that was published in 1948. And the section was called The Gynecology of Homosexuality. It included a number of studies, very careful measurements of the bodies of lesbian women, and also drawings of their genitalia with names of each person next to the drawing of the cunt, which is supposedly on the person indicated. I made a wig which was a hybrid of one Hogarth wig and one of these deviant cunts. And then I just decided to go for broke and make a set of six red wigs. I grew up in a society where gender was very important, and particularly being male had a high premium. And I've always been attracted to and obsessed by people who were able to transcend that. I am a transsexual. Since my earliest memories, I've always wanted to be a woman. That desire has caused me just unfold misery. It's been a burden for me all these years, the secrecy, the shame, the hiding. I'm an engineer. For a long time, coming out of work was the scariest thing in the world to me. Of course, it was very threatening. I might lose my job, nobody might want to hire me. And I love design. I love my work. Coming out at work, being able to be myself, is just the most liberating experience that I could imagine for myself.
For 20 years, I've been photographing people who are third gender, who are neither male nor female. And it's not about men dressing as women. I'm interested in people who have redefined their gender altogether. Relationships, and I see the pain that transsexuals have. I'm very conscious of it in Berlin, living with Joey and walking down the street with him, her, and just having people unable to ascribe a gender to her, and how far that makes people. So I have enormous respect for the struggle that it involves. The picture of Joey in my mirror at Hornstrasse was taken while I was living in Berlin. She's a pre-op transsexual. We became very close. When I was 18, I was on the street near Salvation Army in downtown Boston, actually Morgan Memorial, and I saw these three people, and I thought they were the most beautiful people I'd ever seen in my life. And I started following them, and they were the queens that I became obsessed with and moved in with on Beacon Hill in 1972. I was almost lavishly devoted to them. I was younger than them. They were my whole life. They were my entire context. That's how I became a photographer. My 20 years of photographing transvestites and transsexuals is really an ode and an homage to beauty. This whole new breed of queens from the 90s, it's somewhere beyond any gender choice I've ever seen. It's beyond even wondering what gender.
Free gets rid of the notion of maleness and femaleness as the beginning and the end of gender possibility. It opens itself up to gender blur, to gender consternation, to she-males, to cross-dressers, to drag, to a whole range of transgender possibilities. Possibilities that are constantly remaking themselves, and where we can't even imagine where that pathway to infinity will lead.
Thank you. So I think we'll take some time for any comments or questions, realizing that being human on the planet sort of iffy in many ways. I find myself a lot of time walking around acting as if I had sort of a sense of what it is to be a human on the planet, and then at the best of times knowing that there's a great difference between being a human on the planet and being God. And a lot of, I think, what we do in the area of sexuality is act as if we were God. And I hope the video has sort of gotten us a little uncomfortable or a little comfortable, depending. But in our conversation now, there is no wrong thing to say if it's what you want to say, with the remembrance that we're a very complicated group of people in the room. You have no idea right now, I suspect, whether Elizabeth Bettenhausen is male or female. Is she cross-dressing? Is she... Were her grandparents, were her great-grandparents slaves? What is her race? Who concocted the category of race? Which, by the way, was concocted by whites in the 18th century. So, any responses or anything you want to say at this point? And you don't have.
Well, as far as gender, I still think that form follows function.
Now, I love that theory in Lewis Sullivan, in architecture in Chicago in the early part of the century, but you have to tell me what you mean, or tell
well,
us.
Well, I mean that I think that there are two genders, and if there's another one, then it'd be a non-gender. It'd be a, if there's an in-between state, that's what it is, it wouldn't have a label. And if you don't want any labels, you know, I don't care how people dress, but I still say that your sex is given to you and you can't change it, and even if you're not comfortable with it, you can dress different, but that's not going to change your sex.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's right.
I just want to say one thing. I found, I'm really amazed at my reaction. I mean, I'm kind of depressed. And I actually had a friend, I mean, I had been involved with a person at work who's going through sex change. And I remember when I first encountered that and the pain of this person's life and as a person of faith and sort of being involved in that subculture. The thing that came to mind, and I still haven't resolved it or dealt with, and I just give you this question, was, see, the thing is, the question is, did God make a lot of mistakes? And I don't know, I don't know what the answer is, because, like, to the whole, most of the world, it's like either the person is so off base that you can just sort of discount them, you know, and forget that this whole world exists. But it's like when you really meet someone and share the pain of this particular transsexual's situation, the only thing that came to mind was, you know, it's either like you say, it's the complication of being human or whatever, or somewhere a mistake was made, and I don't, you know. So, I mean, that's not an answer or anything, but I found that video fairly overwhelming.
But both the comments so far have moved us right into the heart of some big ethical and theological questions. What is the origin of sexuality? And if, is it God? Is God responsible for making the categories, or? And if we're going to label some mistakes, which ones are the mistakes?
Yeah.
We aren't going to resolve anything tonight, clearly, so we're just
maybe
assembling
tomorrow?
Any...
No.
The end of the week.
It's on the boat Monday. Any other reactions?
Yeah, my reaction was I felt nauseated looking at that movie. And I tried not to, and to... I don't want to say be open-minded, because that might be a lot of junk getting into an open mind, but trying to look at it, trying to understand if that had any meaning to me. And as hard as I tried, whatever deep biases I have were rampant in the sense that they wouldn't allow any meaning to come through. Just, I felt like I wanted to throw up, to tell the truth. And I couldn't get out of that, you know.
I think our bodies tell us a lot about how we understand the world.
My body was telling me, you know, I don't need this. That's what it was telling me.
Were you a little angry that it was more or less inflicted on you by...
No. I didn't feel an anger. I felt that I just don't need, you know, as much as I'm trying to deal with new experiences, this one is not particularly good for me. And for a reason, I think must have a Christian basis to it. It just was putrid, for that would be so.
Yeah, we'll come back, I think, to that.
I have a question. I'm quite conservative, and watching that, the question that I have for you is, I am a Bible-based person because everybody has different opinions, every religion has different beliefs, so I have to sort of focus in on that's where I feel I get my foundation. And just today, my devotion is in Deuteronomy, and it's very specific about women dress as women, men dress as men. And when I see something like that, I just see it as something else to add to the deterioration of society, what is our level of acceptability? I mean, am I so small-minded that I can't accept that? Am I so small-minded that it just seems wrong to me?
Let me, you pose it as a question, and if I may, I'd like to begin some response, but not a long one yet. I taught for 9 years in a seminary at Boston University, which is the United Methodist Seminary, and was helped out of that position, also called fired and such. But all those years that I taught systematic theology and, you know, some of the heavy theology courses in ethics, I never once wore slacks in 9 years.
Wore slacks.
No, black is one of my favorite. You haven't seen me in much else, and this weekend I love blue and black together. But I never wore slacks. Wore a dress absolutely every day in that job. And I did that for one reason, among many, because I knew that I was already suspect as a systematic theologian by virtue of being female. So I had to overemphasize my femininity in order to distract from the attack on my intellect by virtue of being female. But I know that in the 19th century, women were force-fed through tubes down their noses into their stomachs in England and in the United States because they were on hunger strike. And one of the things they fought for, one of them, was the right to wear bloomers. Back in the 19th century, if you had shown up in slacks, you would have been violating codes that were as ancient as Deuteronomy.
But do you think we are evolving to that? That it's slowly coming to that?
No, we are that. That's not the future. That is, and it's not even the present. People have been this richly complicated since, as we'll see tomorrow morning, the Garden of Eden.
But when you read something that's very specific in the Bible, I mean, do you just disregard the Old Testament?
No.
I find it very conflicting within me.
Yeah. It's conflicting in the texts. The Bible is I love reading that. After showing a video like this, now trying to sound a little more something. I find the Bible just massively fascinating because it is this textual data of very complicated, very different people. And what's in the Bible about sexuality is not one clear picture by a long shot. It's this wild, a favorite theologian of mine, Judith Plaskow, is Jewish, and she uses this term in her book, Standing Again at Sinai. The term is God wrestling. And what she's interested in is she says, for Jewish women, it's terrifically difficult because they don't show up in the history officially. They just aren't there. And Christian women the same, in large measure. So what do you do as a woman reading that text? I doubt that any of the women that any of us in this room want to use Leviticus or Deuteronomy as our sexual ethics. Because how many in the room are now menstruating? Oh, come on! What is this?
All right.
Right now?
Right now.
Right now. Right now.
Really? I mean,
they should leave the room.
Exactly right. We should not be in mixed company if we're menstruating as women. And I had on January 7th, I think it was, of 88, almost total hysterectomy, so I don't have to worry about that aspect of life anymore with regard to self-interest. But most of the rules in the Bible that have to do with my body are so degrading of me that I have to say, well, either God didn't dictate that text, or God just hasn't the vaguest idea what menstrual cramps are like. And that's part of we can't pretend there's no dilemma there. Do you, and ritual baths after childbirth? Well, even the Episcopalians finally got rid of that one. Gold earrings, anybody wearing gold earrings in the room? Go back and read 1 Timothy. You're in trouble.
Well, more than that. More than the gold earring.
Yeah, so I don't mean to put down what you're saying at all. You're raising a very, very important issue that we'll have mutually to struggle with in these 4 days.
Well, women do wear whatever they want. They wear what we call men's clothes. Why can't men wear whatever they want? I mean, I don't have any problem with the clothes. But you don't have to wear dresses. But if you want to, go ahead. But that's different from this sexual orientation and...
Well, how do you know it's so different?
Well, because I don't care what they wear, but I think, like she said about, there's got to be limits. Like if you say there's nothing wrong, there's no limits, then the next step is, so there's nothing wrong with incest, there's nothing wrong with anything.
Oh, I don't know that we are so prone to a slippery slope, but maybe.
Well, kind of when I was watching the video, it just made me think that life is complicated, and that people are really complicated. And in some ways, that makes me a little nauseous because it doesn't make life easy for us.
but it doesn't mean it's something I don't want. You know, I guess I've learned about myself that my sexuality, my feelings about myself as a sexual being, is they're very complicated. You know, like, sometimes I see myself as a horrible person because I'm sexual. Other times I see myself as a beautiful person. Sometimes I don't see myself as either. You know, I haven't even had sex yet, and that complicates it just as much. You know what I mean? That affects my sexuality. You know? And so I guess that's the word complicated. Yeah, I guess that's a good word. But you can think of a lot of words that come out from that one. That rich would be another word. Frightening might be another word. Like looking at a complicated math problem, I'm frightened. Looking at people as complicated people is not something that's easy to understand. Sometimes I like it when there are rules that are easy to follow. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I thought.
And maybe sometime tomorrow we can see, just out of this group, what that set of rules might be in response to my question. Yes, rule.
What occurs to me when I watch this, and I know that with these are two different subjects, but as an African American, I do stuff here every day with whites that would be considered wrong in an African American community. That would just, I deal with people, I talk with people, that would just be considered absolutely bizarre in an African American community. And if I can make that switch culturally, I think, you know, if it's that much of a difference culturally, then why, I guess my feeling is, why can't it be that much of a difference sexually?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see a parallel there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm just talking culturally and sexually. I mean, it's just, it's so much, it's so big, because there are other things that, you know, economically, that different people at socioeconomic levels do things that would be considered even wrong at a particular level. It just keeps getting, there are just so many layers.
Mm-hmm. And really crucial there is in which direction is one passing, to use the word out of the film, on both gender and race. Because very rarely do whites in this society find it necessary to have to pass in order to get along through a day as anything other than maybe pass as German instead of Norwegian. But hardly is there a burden on whites, because of the power dynamics, to have to pass as African American or as Sioux. And the same on sexuality. The dominant group isn't obliged to pass.
When I go home, I almost have to do like a check, because my family is very interested on if I've gotten too white.
Mm.
If I talk too white, if I like stuff that's too white. And they let me know, you know, that I've gone a bit too far, you know. And so, and vice versa, you know. So it's a, I don't know, I guess I want to say it's a big world.
Mm.
It's bigger than we think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, but it's not infinite, in spite of what the end of the film said,
mm-hmm.
about going on into infinity. And I think a real question is whether men are obliged to pass as women in ways that women are obliged to pass as men. Whether whites are obliged to pass, etc. That power quest. So that, for example, when you said that you don't care one way or the other about cross-dressing, what you said before, but the thought that came to my mind is, Would you be comfortable if your husband, whom I know you have from our conversations earlier in the day, decided that for the next foreseeable future he would wear dresses?
Well, he wouldn't. He's not as liberal as I am. He's so conservative. So,
but right there, see, you've just named the dominant.
I've seen Scotsmen wear dresses in Scotland, mm-hmm. and it's a costume. That part of it, you know, you dress according to occasions or to where you are, but that doesn't mean that changed you. It's just an outer thing. You got to be able to look your old self in the mirror. That's all I think. And if you're comfortable with yourself, I'm not going to, you know, just don't impinge on my rights either.
I think I understand what you're saying. I'm curious, though, about the social rules. Because there seems to be a social rule in the United States that it's okay for women to wear men's clothes, by and large, but the reverse is okay only in liturgical churches.
Era they wear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the men made that rule. So.
But, and I think it's important to ask why.
Is it okay? And this falls part of what you've been talking about. Is it okay in this country for women to wear men's clothes? Or has the woman decided to get ahead, she needs to dress something like a man?
We have a multitude of women here. What do you think?
Has a man worn girdles? You know, it's like mm-hmm. those things were, I don't know how we can call them, self-imposed.
I guess
no
men have worn
a
girdles.
Woman, but there was a very uncomfortable, personally, wear real high heels and dresses all the time. There's a comfort zone that isn't there when you're constantly dressed up. For me, when I speak for myself, I'm so much more myself and so much more comfortable in casual clothing and not, or maybe a tunic type dress, that style of dress. But unless you make your own clothes or you can have someone make them, you have to get what's out there. Where am I going with that?
My question was a decision question, though. Who's making the decision for what reason? Is it okay to do something, or has somebody or some people, for whatever reason, decided to make a decision to dress in a certain way? It's good to wear a suit today, something like a man with a tie and so forth, mm-hmm. because that kind of thing, if it's dark blue, and of course you get ahead, you know, that's what I'm asking.
Power
so
dressing, they teach that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I guess someone just said it. I mean, who set the pace for power and moving ahead and success in this country? Men, right?
White.
Sort of historically, traditionally, that's been the case, and so if women want to be successful in the areas where success is determined, which is mostly business and academics, the big time, the big standard is a male standard. So women have to dress like men. Men don't have to dress like women to get ahead. That kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Jerome, go ahead.
I think you're holding men past for being sensitive. I mean, you know. I think men pass for being sensitive here at home. I think we sit around and we say things and tolerate things, even in conversation, even a certain amount of male bashing. You know, we tolerate it because, you know, we're trying to be sensitive, we're trying to work something out, or we're kind of passing because we know that's not acceptable here, you know, at home. So I think there's a certain amount of passing on that for males. There's a certain amount of repression of even anger. You know, I mean, there are times in community meetings when I know as a male I want to just jump up and tell somebody where to go. But, you know, you don't do that. You suppress that. And, you know, so I think we're passing, and I don't know if passing and suppressing are the same word. I don't know, but I think we're passing in that respect here in Holden a lot as a male. I think I do.
I didn't find that the movie goes going deep enough for me. I felt it, I was disappointed, and then it kind of stayed on the surface, you know, talking about, you know, clothes and that kind of stuff. But I was kind of wondering what's below that. You know, I was thinking that, like in looking at animals, that the male is very often much more outstanding. You know, as far as dressing, you just look at most animals, you know, and that kind of confuses me, because they're in the animal world, they're just, you know, they're just more flamboyant, and they do the dancing and everything, but the human, and I guess I was maybe looking at the movie kind of like, what are they driving at? They seem to be surfaces, not going deep enough.
Do you have any inkling what questions would be at that level that you would see as deeper?
What's behind sexuality? Why are we sexual? Why do we have that drive? It's not only for bringing forth children. It's more. Deeper, it's more pervasive. I didn't seem to, that didn't come across to me in the film.
I think one of the ideological claims in the film that is going to come up again in the weekend is whether in a culture of radical pluralism morally, it is possible to have anything other than the certain